You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Monday, December 19th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening.
And we have two special guests joining us for the show. For the entire show as a guest rogue, we have George Krob.
Nice pronunciation. Hi.
My pleasure.
He put a lot of thought into that, too.
Finally got it right.
George is a musician and a skeptic and the producer of the Geologic Podcast, which if you don't listen to, you should. And we have Jamie Ian Swiss. Jamie, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, how you doing?
Jamie is also he's a magician and author, a skeptic, advisor to the JREF, and also to Nexus. So actually you advise two organizations, and a good friend of the SGU. So welcome back, Jamie.
Great to be back.
We are gathered here, all of us, to talk about the passing of Christopher Hitchens. Christopher Hitchens died last week, right after we recorded the previous week's show. I made a brief mention of it at the end, but now we've had a few days to gather our thoughts and to talk about him. There is a lot to talk about. Jay, you prepared a biography for us in case any of our listeners don't know who Christopher Hitchens was.
Real quick, this is a one-page quickie. Christopher Eric Hitchens was born April 13th in 1949 in Portsmouth, England. He went on to school himself at Leys School in Cambridge, and then he went to Balliol College in Oxford. And while there, he studied philosophy, politics, and economics, which comes as no surprise to me to hear that those were his three first big topics that he studied. In 1960, he was a political activist, and he felt an affinity with the counterculture and protest movements of that time. And I like to think of Hitchens, you know, enjoying the madness of the late 60s while, you know, percolating his early mind on who he became to be.
Right.
He started his career as a journalist in the 70s, working for the New Statesman, meeting and making friends with authors like Martin Amis and Ian McEwan. It was at the New Statesman that he developed a reputation as a fierce left-winger, and he strongly criticized the Vietnam War, Henry Kissinger, and not surprisingly, the Roman Catholic Church. He moved to America in 81, writing for a periodical called The Nation. He wrote critical articles at that time about Reagan, Bush, and foreign policy. In 89, he married Carol Blue, but he had two children with his previous wife. And in 92, he became a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, which he ended up writing for the rest of his life. He developed his reputation and career writing provocative essays on foreign policy, Henry Kissinger, Bill Clinton, and books like, in 1995, The Missionary Position, Mother Teresa in Theory and Practice. Very, very awesome book that he wrote. And also in 2007, he wrote God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, another must-read book from him. In 2003, he wrote that his daily intake of alcohol was enough to kill or stun the average mule, noting that many great writers did some of their finest work when blotto, smashed, polluted, shit-faced, squiffy, whiffled, and three sheets to the wind. And then going on with that theme, in 2011, he reflected about his chosen lifestyle that supported his career as a writer. And this is a quote. "I always knew there was a risk in the bohemian lifestyle. I decided to take it because it helped my concentration. It stopped me being bored. It stopped other people being bored. It would make me want to prolong the conversation and enhance the moment. If you ask, would I do it again, I would probably say yes. But I would have quit earlier hoping to get away with the whole thing. I decided all of life is a wager and I'm going to wager on this bit. In a strange way, I don't regret it. It's just impossible for me to picture life without wine and other things, fueling the company, keeping me reading, energizing me. It worked for me." And of course, on the 15th of December this year, 2011, Christopher Hitchens died from pneumonia in Houston, Texas.
Jay, you left out that in January of 2007, Christopher Hitchens perhaps had the signature interview of his career.
Wow. How could I miss that, Steve?
With the SGU. I mean, come on.
I remember that was a real interesting interview. It was fun for me to see Steve kind of in awe of somebody we were interviewing, which which has only happened a couple other times. And I think it was for Jamie and Gio, of course.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's nice to be back on the show, yeah.
This was a this was at TAM, right? You guys were like in the room with him. This wasn't TAM, over
yeah,
Skype.
Yeah, it was a live interview at TAM 5, yeah.
Right. Did he have any kind of, speaking of that, did he have any kind of rules? Did he say, like, don't talk about this or I don't want to talk about that?
Quite the opposite. Nah. We had to keep reminding him that the microphones were on.
Wow.
And he'd say, you know, we'd just shrug and go on.
That's right. You know, like halfway through the interview, we exchanged looks like he is aware that we're recording this for broadcast, right?
But I think it's when he had some choice words for Diane Sawyer.
Yeah, the Diane Sawyer story was particularly galling.
Needless to say, we recommend the uncensored interview.
Yeah. Jamie, right, didn't you had some interaction with Hitchens during TAM 5, right?
Moderated a panel that Christopher Penn Teller, Randy Shermer, Julius Sweeney, I think were the
members. I remember that panel.
It was TAM 5.
Yeah. That night or the next night, he and I had dinner together. I was very fortunate that it was one of these dinners that was so big. It was these long tables. It wasn't a formal dinner. And we ended up basically being locked in a two-man conversation for the entire duration of the dinner. And we debated and argued politics for quite some time.
How'd you do?
Well, you know, I have this little moment, this tiny, tiny moment of victory in a way. And I mean, I say this really kind of almost tongue in cheek in terms of any significance other than personal significance for me. But this was when he was really at the height of his carrying on about when he had switched sides and was firmly in support of the Bush war in Iraq. And, you know, this was the one arena. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Hitchens, and I was a fan of his work as a literary essayist before he sort of came into the skeptic atheist fold. But his politics are quite another matter, and I was not such a fan. And we were sitting and debating this a little bit, and I said to him, well, you have a strong historical perspective. And given your historical perspective, can you cite me an example in history in which such a policy was successful? And and there was a pause, and he went, no. And there was another pause of about 2 or 3 seconds, you know, the best 2 or 3 seconds of silence in my life. And then he went, but nevertheless, you know, and then he kind of went on, you know, it wasn't about to be stopped for long. But that was that was my little, I managed to, you know, trip him up for a moment. And I saw him just a couple of other times. I attended a talk that he did. You know, he wrote a book about Thomas Paine. And, of course, he was often compared to Paine. And I saw him do a talk in New York City about Thomas Paine. And we spent some time afterwards telling dirty jokes and so on. But the talk itself, I mean, this was a guy who could roll sentences off his tongue that were literally breathtaking, literally would take your breath away. You know, there's stories about his writing process in which he would basically sit at the word processor or the typewriter and the sheets would come out single draft and go in the envelope and go away. You know, I mean, he just he didn't rewrite much, at least in his columns and essays. And it was believable when you saw him talk and just spontaneously. I remember him saying something about, this is from my notes, because I remember early in the talk, he said, you have to be a spellbinding speaker to talk for 40 minutes, which is what he was supposed to talk for. And he says, but if you're spellbinding, you don't really need 40 minutes.
Cool.
But the line that killed me was something like, it was close to this. My research indicates that no one comes out ahead in the short time between being expelled from the universe and hammering up against the wall, the opposite wall that's studded with nails on the other side. And this just kind of, you know, this just kind of fell out of his mouth in the course of some long verbal flourish. It was just remarkable, absolutely remarkable. The command, the erudition and command of the language was astonishing, mixed with an amount of charm that no one human being should be allowed to have.
He definitely is very quote worthy. You know, I've been reading his columns for years, and he is amazingly eloquent. I do have some of my favorite quotes from him, or at least it's hard to, you know, again, it's like hard to go back and say, like, what are my quote unquote favorite quotes? But there are a few that stick out. I don't know if you guys gathered some as well.
Yeah.
Was it Hitchens who said, it's not what you think, it's how you think?
I don't know.
I mean, it's certainly an idea. It's certainly an idea he spoke to and used. I don't think the phrase was original with him, but I think that's one of the things that's important to remember about his, you know, polemicism in the world of atheism, among others, which is that, you know, religionists would talk with him and debate him and engage him, because I think he really did believe it's not just what you think. It is how you think. And I think as a skeptical activist, that's a phrase that really speaks to me. Indeed, it's really why I've always been a skeptic activist rather than an atheist activist per se, because I think the notion of the skeptical movement is not so much about what you think, but is about how you think.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. He also said, one of his more famous skeptical quotes is, what can be asserted without proof can be dismissed without proof.
Mm. Right, yes, indeed.
And he also said, the person who is certain and who claims divine warrant for a certainty belongs now to the infancy of our species.
Awesome.
I love that he was one of the last people you could see on TV who would still smoke. He was pretty much he was the last guy who would drink on camera and smoke on camera, not as a character, but as himself. And it harkened back to a time where you would see Johnny Carson smoking in the 70s or 60s or 50s, and guests would smoke, and Dean Martin would come on and he'd be smoking. And it kind of was this very strange and very tenuous bridge to this kind of past entertainer's pantheon.
He was relentlessly himself, and I think that – you know, it's one thing to call him a polemicist, and I guess you can't deny that at a certain aspect of his presence. But it's often you also see the term contrarian, and I would dispute that term. I think it's unfair to him, because I think people who have trouble believing that a guy could write a book about Mother Teresa or God not being great, you know, could simply be saying what he thinks and not be saying it for the cause of impact. And it's not that he was I'm not saying he was unaware of the impact, obviously, but I really do think that that term contrarian becomes insulting to someone like Hitchens, who really just believed in saying what he actually thought and not being inhibited about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's what Katha Pollitt, one of his co-workers, I guess you would say, at The Nation, had to say in her sort of tribute article to Hitchens, was that one of the things that made him both awe-inspiring and also made him a bit difficult sometimes to deal with was the fact that he never really seemed to have a moment of doubt about anything he said. He had complete and utter conviction in his beliefs, and that's what made him such a vicious opponent when it came to debates, whether it was about religion or politics or anything. He just would not lose because of that conviction.
That's a great point, Rebecca. He was one of the finest debaters of our time, probably in our generation. I mean, you'd see him on stage, you watch videos of him on stage in debates and stuff. He went unmatched, I felt. I don't know there was ever a time that he either felt beat or was beat. I could not find anything.
He always took his time. His ability to be on stage and to take his time with his point, that to me was always so impressive. Because normally when you're sitting and you're having, and you feel ambitious about something, or there's some point you want to make, I tend to, you know, I chatter like a monkey because you get excited and say, I'm going to make this point. And this is a great point. And whereas he knew that he would get the point across and he would just take his time, and that magnificent eloquence would come through. And that was always such a just stone cold. I mean, it was like some Quentin Tarantino character or something, you know, it was just so impressive.
You know, it was as if he had read everything and remembered all that he had read. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what made him such a deadly debater, combined with that unapologetic approach to his own position. Did anybody see the piece that Dan Dennett wrote in the Washington Post?
Yeah.
And he tells this great Dan tells this great story. They met, actually, I guess the same time I met Hitchens, I think, because they met at TAM, and I think it was may have been that same TAM, TAM 5, if I'm not mistaken. Dana tells a story of them sharing the stage in 2009 in Mexico at a conference there, and they were engaged in a God debate, basically. There were, after each one had presented his position, then there were rebuttals, and they were allotted each 4 minutes for rebuttal. It was a very strict kind of format. And now I'll just read here briefly from Dennett. And he says, and the rabbi launched into a series of outrageous claims, trying to besmirch Darwin and evolutionary biology by claiming that Hitler was inspired by Darwin to organize slaughters to ensure the survival of the race. I sat there, this is Dennett, dumbfounded and appalled, and tried to figure out how best to rebut this obscene misrepresentation. When my turn came, Christopher didn't wait his turn. Shame, shame, he bellowed, interrupting the rabbi in mid-sentence, and it worked. The other speaker backpedaled, insisting he was only quoting someone who had thus opined, and Christopher had broken the spell, and a particularly noxious spell it was. And then it goes on to say that, you know, this was a dramatic demonstration to him about, as Dennett puts it, when rudeness is called for, you know, that Dennett found himself unwittingly enslaved to the rules of civility when indeed Hitchens had done the better thing.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I like what Stephen Fry had to say about Hitchens on this score. He wrote, he was an educator. He was polemical only in as much as he was naturally disputatious. This is a quality, ironically perhaps, that he might trace to the Talmudic influence of his Jewish genes as much as being a brisk British parliamentarian style or a Hellenic mode of reasoning through argument. No one I've ever met or witnessed spoke better on the hoof. Fry's pretty eloquent himself.
It's funny,
there,
I was going to mention Stephen Fry because when talking about Hitchens and his debating and whether or not he was ever matched, the only time I ever saw anyone on a stage hold their own with Hitchens was Stephen Fry, and it doesn't really count because they were on the same team.
Where was this, Rebecca?
That was the Intelligence Squared debate. It was Hitchens and Fry versus two representatives from the Catholic faith. One was an MP, I believe, and one was a bishop or maybe a cardinal. The topic under discussion was the Catholic Church is a force for good in the world. I don't have the numbers handy, but it was something like going in, maybe 60% of the people were unconvinced either way, 30% were in favor, 10% against, and going out it was like 80% against. It was some incredible turnaround.
Whoa, wow.
And honestly, I think it was as much to do with Stephen Fry as it was Hitchens, but together they were a force to be reckoned with.
What do we think is our responsibility towards his legacy? Because I've been reading a lot of people that have been posting tributes and talking about quotes and talking about what an influence he has been. Do we have a responsibility towards his legacy, and what can we do to maintain not his personal legacy, but sort of what he stood for and the way he stood for it? What can we do?
Well, I mean, I think that being a skeptical activist is pretty strongly in Hitchens' tradition. I mean, I think that just doing that, essentially being unapologetic, being a public intellectual, participating in the public discourse on important issues when it comes to science and reason and critical thinking. You know, that's what he did. That's clearly what he advocated. You know, being intellectually fearless is the perhaps the one legacy that he really would want to leave behind.
I think intellectually and morally fearless is because he was a consummate obsessive truth teller. I also think that he really, there are so many different movements that can claim him as their own or parts of their own. And I think if there's a unifying factor, if you step back a little bit, I mean, we all know him in the skeptic and atheist field, especially. But I think if you step back a little bit, I think he really stood for, in all places, the notion of human dignity. Mm-hmm. I think because if you listen to him about atheism, it's not just about the critical thinking aspect of it. It's not purely about the superstition and the nonsense and the magical thinking. What I believe what he found, what he stated often, was what he found so utterly offensive was the totalitarianism of it.
Oh, yeah.
The notion of a human being subservient. Yep. The notion of a human spirit being owned. And therefore, you know, if you look at the people he went after, the people whose eyes he poked in many different walks of life, whether it was politics or literature or science or religion, I think that outrage, that moral and intellectual outrage, stemmed from that if you were going to diminish human dignity, you were his enemy.
He specifically, in fact, advocated respecting dignity over compassion.
Right.
Here's the quote that I was thinking of. He wrote in Hitch 22, "Shun the transcendent and all who invite you to subordinate or annihilate yourself. Distrust compassion. Prefer dignity for yourself and others."
Precisely.
That's what you're talking about. I'm going to give you my, just cause while we're on quotes, my last sort of favorite Hitch quote, because I think, it summarizes the skeptical activist mindset. "I try to deny myself any illusions or delusions, and I think that this perhaps entitles me to try to deny the same to others, at least as long as they refuse to keep their fantasies to themselves."
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's pretty much the motto of the SGU.
You know, Christopher Hitchens, more than any other writer, someone that I regularly would read their articles and watch his videos and everything, he made me say to myself more than anybody else, "Wow, I've never thought of that before."
Yeah.
He inspired me so many ways and so many different times during my journey as a skeptic. And, you know, even today, like, you guys are reading quotes. You know, it's funny. Like, I know that those must be popular quotes, but a couple of them I never heard before because he's got so much stuff out there, and I can't, you know, I haven't read all of it.
That kind of ties into one feeling that I've been experiencing the past week. This incredible feeling of inadequacy. I feel so utterly inadequate when I go over his accomplishments. It's like, oh my God, what the hell am I doing with my life? Look at this guy. and he makes me want to try that much harder. I'll never reach the heights that he's attained, but he makes me want to just try that much harder to do what I do.
Yeah, the people who knew him personally, you know, he had this close group of writer friends for maybe 30 years or something, including Martin Amis and Ian McEwan and Salman Rushdie. And when you read these people's memorials, and there's a lot of interesting pieces on the web, obviously, have come up in the last week. They're really worth reading. And among other things, they make me envy their personal access to him, because this was a guy who really valued friendship and was obviously a tremendous friend to have. Christopher Buckley, William F. Buckley's son, writes a wonderful piece on the New Yorker blog, and I love this. I'm going to read this quick thing. He says, "When we made a date for a meal over the phone, he'd say, 'It will be a feast of reason and a flow of soul.'" And Buckley goes on to say, "I never doubted that this Rococo phraseology was an original coinage until I chanced on it one day in the pages of P.G. Wodehouse, the writer Christopher perhaps esteemed above all others." I just think it's a lovely phrase, and it speaks to what it was like to be around him personally, which I only had the lightest taste of. But as far as that output, they all talk about his incredible work ethic and his output. And in some other pieces like this that I've read in the last week, Jane Meyer, a longtime veteran New Yorker writer, writes a short piece. She didn't know him well, but she knew him for many years, 30 years. And when he told her that he had cancer, she was devastated and basically sort of couldn't function for the next few days. And at the end of those few days, she looked back, or a week later, she looked back over those few days, and she realized that he had written, you know, several extraordinary pieces in that time that she was having trouble functioning. And in The Guardian, Ian McEwan writes about visiting Hitchens and really in the last week, days of his life, and talks about him setting him up at a desk under a window with his pole and his feed lines and arranging pillows and adjusting the height of his laptop. And he only had a few days to produce 3,000 words on a biography of J.K. Chesterton. And now I'm quoting from McEwen. Consider the mix. Chronic pain, weak as a kitten, morphine dragging him down, then the tangle of Reformation theology and politics, Chesterton's romantic imagined England suffused with the kind of Catholicism that mediated his brush with fascism and his taste for paradox, which Christopher wanted to debunk. At intervals, his head would droop, his eyes close, then with superhuman effort, he would drag himself awake to type another line.
Oh, God.
Oh, wow.
Jeez. You know, that paints images of maybe what Carl Sagan was also going through in his last days. I can't help but equate the two in my mind. I mean, even though they're set really at, you know, different fields and everything, but these are people from our skeptical movement and from the great, great minds of the world that were taken before their time was really up. And that's the tragedy.
Someone said that it wasn't so much that he wanted to party and drink and smoke and all the late nights and all the things, but that he never wanted to miss a conversation. I love that phrase, and that was something that I took to heart in terms of, you know, when you're hanging out at a TAM or when you're hanging out at Nexus or whatever it is, and you wonder, you know, it's 2 a.m., it's 3 a.m., it's 4 a.m., and people are still hanging out. That feeling that makes me not want to go to sleep is that exact essence, that idea of I don't want to miss a conversation, because some conversation might imbue you with a piece of information that you never thought of before, or a viewpoint that you never had before, and that the potentiality of missing that is worth not sleeping. I love that. I thought that was so interesting.
He took what he was given. You know, let's face it, guys, no matter how hard any of us tried to even come close to where he was, you have to be born incredibly talented and incredibly lucky to have a mind like his.
I don't know if you want to rob him of his genius either by saying that, you know, it's something that is inherent within his brain structure or something too. I mean, I'm sure he put in his 10,000 hours the Gladwell talks
Gladwell,
about.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to.
You have to be born a mutant and then put your time in as well. He's not just going to walk.
You think so?
Absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
I don't know if it's mutant or if it's a slight percentage advantage maybe, but I hate to take away from someone's work and effort, you know, to just say, well, I could never be like that because he's just a genius and that's just the way it is.
I agree with George.
And I couldn't ever be like that.
This is a side conversation. This is controversial. The question of, you know, are experts or geniuses or whatever, brilliant people, are they made or are they born? You know, essentially, is it inherent talent or is it the 10,000 hours? And I think it's both, and I will maybe extrapolate from a recent article we discussed about people who become chess masters that you have to put in a minimal amount of time, like 3,000 hours to get to a certain level, but the amount of hours that an individual has to put in is greatly variable. Some people need to put 10,000 hours in to get to that point. Other people need to put 15,000 in. Some could just put 3, but it's never less than a certain amount. I like to focus on the work, because anybody can do that. And I often think that, you know, emphasizing the inherent is often an excuse not to do the work.
Right. And that's where I agree with you, George. It's always insulting. I don't believe in gifts. You know, I think it's nonsense to talk about gifts, and it's an insult and an excuse that come from people who don't understand what it means to work that hard.
Well, I disagree with the three of you, and I'm not afraid to do it.
Evan, to bring us back more to Christopher Hitchens, do you have some audio clips of some of his performances that we'd like to share?
Yeah, I do, Steve. And, okay, I mean, just so much to have pulled off the internet, thousands of hours of material basically on Hitchens. There's no shortage. Just here's one little sample. Here we go.
If it was true, it would have two further implications. It would have to mean that the designer of this plan was unbelievably lazy and inept, or unbelievably callous and cruel and indifferent and capricious. And that is the case with every argument for design and every argument for revelation and intervention that has ever been made.
Yeah, I think it's not only undeniably true, but I have to say, it reminds me exactly, isn't that the whole point of Mr. Deity, of Brian Keith Dalton's web show, Mr. Deity, right?
Yeah.
You know, if that were true, the designer of the plan was unbelievably lazy, inept, unbelievably callous and cruel, indifferent and capricious. Hey, it's Mr. Deity.
That's right. It's true.
Right.
That's what's funny about that show.
I got a good quote here, guys. Beware the irrational, however seductive. Shun the transcendent and all who invite you to subordinate or annihilate yourself. Distrust compassion. Prefer dignity for yourself and others. Don't be afraid to be thought arrogant or selfish. Picture all experts as if they were mammals. Never be a spectator of unfairness or stupidity. Seek out argument and disputation for their own sake. The grave will supply plenty of time for silence. Suspect your own motives and all excuses. Do not live for others any more than you would expect others to live for you. Damn, that is so good.
My favorite part of that actually is do not be a spectator
yes.
of unfairness mm-hmm. or stupidity.
Yes.
And this is something that we face so much of, that what we call the shruggies, the people who are just like, meh, you know, what's the harm mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. who cares? Why are you so exercised about this? Why do you care so much about
this?
Doesn't
affect me.
It's like, because I don't want to be a spectator right. to massive stupidity and not say anything about it.
Hitchin said so much as that yeah. on many occasions. He said, yeah, I could be home at nights enjoying, you know, just doing whatever I want to do, but I feel much more fulfillment being out there and trying to make a difference.
The mammals thing is so great that, yeah. you know, yeah. the most brilliant or respected person in essence is a mammal, and a mammal can be wrong. That's when I first read Missionary Position. I mean, you never would question Mother Teresa's sincerity. And yet he did exactly that. And he argued why she should not be seen as the holiest of holy figures that she is seen. And that you know, his book is encapsulated right there. You know, that remember, these are just mammals. It's great.
Yeah, and so I think if we're going to have this sort of, you know, conversation about, you know, how do you best serve his memory, I think that's the thing. It's not about being a great writer, a great orator, or imitating any of these specifics. It's about speaking up and not being a passive witness.
Well, Jamie, thanks for joining us for this
My pleasure.
Discussion.
Thank you so much for inviting. Thank you so much for inviting.
And before we let you go, tell us what you're up to.
What am I up to? Well, as you guys know, I'm busy. We're busy planning Nexus, most of us, the next Nexus convention, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, coming up in April, and we're going to have big announcements about that within the next just couple of weeks. So stay tuned for that. We're busy with that. Over at JREF, we're busy with a number of things, including our Season of Reason. We've got some matching donors. It's really a fantastic and important time to contribute to JREF. We have free gifts. We have Christmas tree ornaments for donors, among other things. But we also have some people who are matching dollars just only within the next week on donations. So come and give some money to JREF so we can continue our work. And, of course, I'm working on TAM for next year too. So
great. Okay. Well, thanks, Jamie.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to share this conversation and these memories with you.
You too, Jamie. Yeah. Talk to you soon.
You bet.
Yep.
Well, let's turn now to some news items. Rebecca, you're going to start by telling us some Neanderthal/mammoth news.
So yes, there's exciting Neanderthal news. I know you're all on the edge of your seats.
I read Mammoth Monthly.
Thank you for the Neanderthal news, yes. opening theme song.
I think we're back to Neanderthal, but go ahead.
Wait, what?
Oh, again?
some of us never left the Neanderthal.
No, I've been Neanderthal all the way my whole life. I'm not going to switch now.
Now, see, so, I was born in the Neanderthal era, and I'm happy it's back to the Neanderthal, and that crazy Neanderthal interlude we had is over.
Oh, God, silent ages are
that weird Neanderthal acid trip that the whole scientific community went through. Well, yeah, I'm absolutely. Sticking with it. So, you know what? Deal, Steve. Steve's going to go back in and edit this to add a th every time I say Neanderthal. Okay, so yes, for a long time, Neanderthals have gotten the short end of the stick. You know, they're the ugly, primitive cave dwellers who were literally too stupid to survive, while Homo sapiens, of course, flourished. But over the past decade or so, there's been more and more research that's been showing that they were, in fact, kind of awesome. For instance, they've been shown, we've talked about this in the past, that they may have interbred with Homo sapiens. They may have had a language. They may have developed tools. And they may have just been more intelligent than previously thought. So this news fits in with that. Archaeologists have now discovered that Neanderthals demonstrated the most badass behavior possible. I believe, which is hunting and killing very large prey and then using the prey's bones to make a house. The house in question dates to about 44,000 years ago. It was circular, and it was up to 26 feet across.
Damn, that's big. Did it pass inspection?
It's quite large. Mm-hmm.
Did it have multiple rooms?
Not that I know of, although it did have 25 hearths. Hearths.
Yeah.
I don't know why I said
no,
it.
No, that's two. It's hearts. The T is the H.
Two of hearths.
Yes, there were 25 hearths, and they were full of ash, which led the researchers to believe that this building had actually been used for a long time, which indicates that Neanderthals weren't necessarily as nomadic as previously believed. And the house itself sounds absolutely awesome. It was constructed out of 116 bones, and they used the largest woolly mammoth bones they could find, like skulls, legs, and tusks.
Makes sense.
Yeah, that's how they built their house. And the other cool feature of it was that many of the bones were decorated with carvings and ochre pigments, which lent some credibility to the theory that Neanderthals had an artistic culture.
Look at the bones.
There's also apparently some evidence that they were using that they would use a wisecracking pig for a garbage disposal.
Flintstones.
No, nothing. No.
That is definitely the most badass house I've heard of this year.
Right? It's better even than the Tauntaun. Is that what it is? Tauntaun. It's better than a Tauntaun house even.
But not as cool as a zombie house.
A house constructed entirely of zombies?
A zombie
by zombies.
I guess I'd.
Wouldn't it like reach out and grab you and try to kill you? That's a terrible idea for a house, Bob.
How
terrible
would you get any sleep in that freaking house, Bob?
Yeah, you would just die.
Or is that a house that uses like zombie contractors? Like a zombie
built
by zombies.
Well, then it wouldn't adhere to our conditions here, which is a house made entirely out of bone. And this actually is the oldest house made out of bone that has ever been found. There are older structures dating back to several hundred of thousands of years that were constructed out of wood. But in this case, it's the oldest one out of bone, which is interesting because wood may have been scarce in these areas, so they would have had to have gone out of the way to find some other way to build a structure.
What with the glaciers and all.
Yeah, made it kind of tricky.
Right. But there were these large moving houses wandering around, and all you had to do was kill them.
Although, well, they did hunt and kill most of them, but according to the researchers, some of the bones appeared to have been scavenged from woolly mammoths that had died naturally.
Yeah, why not? Just sitting there.
That's where the phrase comes from, a man's home is his calcium.
Oh.
That's points for quickness.
Quickness counts. But
that's all the points you get.
That's all the
right. Half a point.
Of course, when I imagine this house built out of mammoth tusks, I can't help seeing an orc fort from World of Warcraft.
Oh, God.
Isn't that what it would look like?
That's because you're a dork.
Of course. I think that goes without saying.
Yes.
Steve, don't you know that World of Warcraft isn't cool anymore?
It's not nerd cool anymore?
No. It's all about Rift now.
Or Skyrim.
And Skyrim.
It's all about Skyrim.
Come on.
Or Old Republic.
So now we're coming back to the future with a camera that can produce a trillion frames per second. Bob, tell us about that.
If you insist. It looks like the quest for the it looks like the quest for the fastest camera may have reached its apex. Scientists at MIT Media Lab have created a camera that takes images at the astounding speed of, as Steve said, 1 trillion frames per second. This is so fast that this camera can apparently take slow motion video of light moseying its way down the length of a 1 liter bottle of water, an empty bottle of water, and back again. I wish I could find a little bit more information.
Empty bottle of water? You mean a bottle?
A 1 liter bottle of something
air
that used to have water in it.
Okay.
Yeah. So Andreas Velten is a postdoctoral associate on the team. On the team that created this example of femtophotography, he said that there's nothing in the universe that looks fast to this camera, and I don't think he ever saw Jay eat meatballs, otherwise he might not have said that. But typical, you know, the typical slow motion photography at the movies is usually at 48 frames per second, which seems pretty slow now, or actually pretty fast, or it depends how you look at it, I guess. But yes. Of course, you're not going to be seeing this technology soon on your iPhone 5, 6, or even 7, or even the best IMAX camera. Right now, this is a pretty expensive piece of equipment. It's about $250,000 American dollars, and it's so specialized that for the foreseeable future, I guess we'll probably only be seeing it in science and medical labs.
Yeah, Bob, next year the Japanese will have one for $50 for Christmas.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you might not still think that once you find out how this thing actually works.
All right, go ahead.
It works like a conventional camera in that light is obviously some kind of light is used to reflect off of a scene of interest, and then that light is reflected back and gathered into a series of images to make the moving video. The reflected light, though, that comes for this device is a really sweet picosecond laser that shoots pulses of laser light that lasts about a trillionth of a second, hence the trillion frames per second. The camera, though, as you might expect, has some serious drawbacks. Because the field of view of the camera is so narrow, it essentially takes these snapshots of one spatial dimension at a time. It's like one thin line. So what you end up with when you take that first really fast picture is this just a line. So after you take this frame, you have to kind of stitch all these thin slices together to actually create a video. So you've got to actually recreate the thing you want to take an image of over and over and over. And so it's kind of funny that they call this the slowest, fastest camera in the world, because it does take quite a while to actually build up this two-dimensional image.
So they have to keep shooting that single pulse of light over and over and over again. So it's not a single event that they're photographing, right?
Yeah, and I'm not sure how they actually pull that off. The details were not really there in a lot of the websites that I checked out. I mean, for some scenes, yes, you can recreate them faithfully and make it and end up with a video image that faithfully reproduces what they were trying to do. But for the light, I'm not sure how they would actually do that.
So it's not really a trillion frames a second. It's a representation of what that would look like if you could have a camera that did that, right? It's a slight difference, but.
A subtle difference, but it is, you are seeing these things in incredibly, in incredible slow motion, and you are seeing at least this light, you know, these extended different scenes of light traversing the bottle. You are seeing it as pretty much as you would, as it would be if you could take them, you know, bam, 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 like you normally would conceive of a slow motion camera.
Yeah, but George is right. When I was reading this, that's also the sense of the guys. They're creating the effect of a camera that had that frame rate, but they don't really have a camera that.
Yeah, because they're pulsing that single pulse through that bottle every single time that they have to get that sliver that you mentioned.
Right.
So it's like this is a composite of a trillion light pulses. I don't know. It just seems like it was deceptive that, like, yeah, we're going to have a trillion second camera very soon. I mean, it's amazing and it's mind numbing how cool this thing is, but it's like recreating an event as opposed to actually photographing.
Yeah, it was a really interesting wrinkle that was a little bit disappointing. But since this is like a generation one of this device, who knows?
Yeah,
that's
what I look at it. Like, you know, in the future, though, George, they'll probably increase the speed and also probably multiply the thing that's taking the picture
right
by 1,000. Say, you know what I mean?
Like, but I want it now.
So one more news item. We talked about neti pots in the past. Do you guys remember the discussion of neti pots?
Uh-huh. Not at all.
Here's the quick version of what we discussed previously, then I'll give you the update. A neti pot looks like a little teapot almost, but it has a long snout, and you're supposed to put hot water in it and then pour it up your nose and irrigate your sinuses to flush your sinuses. It's a little trendy now. I reviewed the evidence for it, and you could break it down into two basic categories. Evidence for using a neti pot chronically as a way of preventing illness or maintaining your mucosal health, or whatever you want to call it. The evidence actually suggests that there is no benefit for the chronic or routine use of a neti pot. In fact, it's probably counterproductive. Or the other category is the use of a neti pot when you have an acute sinus infection, and you have a buildup or a backup of mucus in your sinuses. And there is evidence that it is useful, that it helps irrigate, get flush the sinuses, get rid of all of the backed up mucus that's infected, and helps fight off the infection more quickly. It's nothing revolutionary. I mean, this is a basic concept in medicine. If you have any kind of an infection that is occupying a space like that, that if you wash it out, it helps the body get rid of the infection. So not surprising. And the bottom line was, if you have an acute infection and you want to wash out your sinuses, it may help, but I wouldn't use it routinely. It's actually probably counterproductive if used on a regular basis when you're
not sick. When you pour the water in one nostril, where does it go?
It comes out the other
one.
To your
brain.
It just it comes out your nose. You slosh it around your sinuses. And
your
it comes
ears.
Out.
Have you ever tried one?
No. Never tried one.
Are you going to?
No. I don't know. Maybe if I'm...
I have one. I've yet to actually try it. I was waiting to get
it.
Get mucusy.
Yeah.
First.
Well, there is a report of two cases, and it's hard to make too many conclusions from two cases, but it's perhaps something to be concerned about, of individuals who became infected with, get this, a brain-eating amoeba after using a neti pot. Brain-eating amoebas.
So there was a brain-eating amoeba in the water in the neti pot?
Yes, that's correct. The specific species is Naegleria fowleri, or fowleri, which is can be a nasty infection, can cause a meningoencephalitis if it gets in. It's a very short trip from the nose to the brain, and that's a very common pathway for CNS infections or infections of the brain. We get very worried when there's any kind of infection going on in that area. That and the eyes, because, again, there's like holes behind your eyes, where the nerve goes through a short trip right back to your brain. And there's also a very thin piece of bone at the top of your nose that separates it from your brain.
I don't know why, but it freaks me out to hear you talk about holes behind my eyeballs.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Yep.
That's creepy.
Yep.
I don't like hearing it.
Right.
Go on.
Yeah. So it's just pathways.
That's where Norman Bates looks in.
Yeah.
Because we're basically made of paper,
Right. That's
where your ear holes, mouth.
Critters can get access to your central nervous system.
Oh, yeah.
So that's
worms,
dangerous.
And spiders.
Sticking more about bacteria, amoeba, and viruses. But again, it's hard to prove that the use of the neti pot in these two cases, one was a 51-year-old woman, one was a 20-year-old man, actually led to the infection. But there was a temporal correlation. Did, happen after using the neti pot. And in both cases, they used tap water, which is a no-no. You're not supposed to do that. If for some reason you feel like you want to use a neti pot, again, I only recommend it using it during an acute infection, you should use distilled water, sterile saline, or previously boiled water.
Don't drink the distilled water.
Yeah. Don't drink the distilled water. Don't use the water while it still is boiling.
Water is so dangerous. I can't remember all this.
But don't use just, warm water fresh out of your tap or your well or whatever, because that contains organisms. Now, it's safe to drink this water because your stomach acids will kill a lot of these organisms, and your stomach evolved to tolerate the fact that you're going to consume a lot of bacteria.
So my stomach is so strong, it can kill something that could just total my brain.
Yeah, but putting it into your sinuses, that's a different story.
Your stomach could dissolve your brain.
Yeah, can I use the stomach acid in the neti pot? Would that solve the problem?
Yeah,
solve
that right into your brain.
Yeah, what does science have to say about that, Steve?
Yeah. Well, Dr. Holes in the back of your eyes.
Your nose and your sinuses did not evolve to tolerate the acids in your stomach, so I would not recommend that. The acids in your stomach should stay in your stomach, and it's okay to drink water and things that have organisms in them, but you have to be careful about squirting them up your butt or in your nose or into other cavities or mucous membranes that were not meant to tolerate that sort of exposure. Right, so be careful with your neti pots, which are probably unnecessary anyway.
Who's that? Noisy! Who's that noisy?
Wow, that was cool. That's new. That's exciting.
I wonder who made that.
Where could that possibly have come from?
Who likes to make weird sounding things, you know, and record them for people?
Perverts, mostly.
Perverts, exactly.
Exactly.
I'm glad I can be part of the show every week now and annoy your listeners just a little bit for like 15 seconds every week.
Reminder.
Whatever, 5 seconds every week.
Last week's Who's That Noise? Now remember, not just what you're listening to, but how you're hearing it. That was the clue for the noisy. Here we go. Did you detect a rhythm in there? Perhaps a synthetic rhythm, right? Something that wasn't...
Absolutely, yes.
Had a definitely constructed, designed sort of little beat to it.
Right? What could it be?
What could it possibly be? Well, perhaps it was music. But it's what music sounds like to someone who has a cochlear implant.
Was it a little bit of a Ludwig von?
A little bit of the, yes, Ninth Symphony, Fourth Movement. No, from his Kreutzer Sonata. On the website auditoryneuroscience.com, they describe how cochlear implants do a very poor job of conveying musical pitch, and this was an example.
Yeah, that sucked.
Yeah. They give you, you know, the how it normally sounds and then how it sounds through the cochlear implant, which is what you just heard. So, you know.
So, with the, you know, cochlear implants, I guess it's better than nothing, but man, they have a long way to go.
Thanks to Mackie Drew from Oshawa, Ontario, Canada, for sending us that noisy. And he happened to stump the listeners.
Excellent.
Lots of interesting guesses, but nobody got it right.
Nobody so even well got done, the Mackie. Cochlear implant part. I mean, I wouldn't no expect them to recognize the sonata, but I mean, if they nobody got cochlear implant.
Nobody got cochlear implant.
That was a challenging one. Challenging.
Yes, it was.
All right, Evan, the last Who's That Noisy of 2011. We'll do the reveal next year.
All right. This week's Who's That Noisy.
Peculiar phenomena is the closeness of the horizon due to the greater curvature of the moon than we have here on Earth, of course, 4 times greater.
There's your science lesson for the night, contained in your Who's That Noisy.
The horizon on the moon is closer. All right, thanks, Evan.
Think about that and give it your best guess. Good luck to everyone, and talk to you next year about it.
Old Lang Noisy.
I smell another That's musical piece by George.
All right, George, you're going to give a special report to us on randomness because you told us you've been wrestling with this concept on the Geologic podcast.
Yeah,
our input. So get us up to speed.
I
so what you
want
talk
your
about?
Input. I was talking to my listeners. A thing happened during a band break. As you know, I play with the funk band, and we sometimes might have large amounts of time off between sets or whatever. And at one point, we were doing what at the time we didn't realize, but a phrase which is contradictory with itself. Is called a pleonasm, and it's not really like an oxymoron, but it's something like barely pregnant or burning fire. It's kind of a phrase that has a contradiction within itself. And we were just trying to kill time, and we were coming up with these things. So we were saying, you know, end result, invited guest, you know, she wept tears, and these are all examples of pleonasms. And then someone
final destination.
Final destination, exactly, perfect. Yeah. Sum total. Yeah.
Sum total.
So this is like instead of drinking like most musicians, this is what we do on our breaks because we're nerds.
Yeah.
And someone said, very random. And I thought, oh, that was cool. That's a good one. And then it kind of struck me and I started to wonder, can you have varying levels of randomness? And the band was stumped, and we sort of finished out the rest of this 20-minute break sort of having a debate about can you have varying degrees of randomness? And for the most part, it seems to be sort of a language problem. However, I presented this to my listeners on the show, and someone wrote – a number of people wrote in, and they had a lot of different sort of mathematical examples about – some in some camp were saying that no, something for something to be truly random, you cannot have a varying level of randomness. Yet someone else said, well, you know, there's this cool example. When iTunes initially had a random option to select within your playlist, it was a truly random option. What would happen occasionally would be that you would get the same song twice in a row. Because if you're legitimately generating a sort of a random set of numbers or random playlist, you might get the same song twice, even three times in a row, you know, over thousands of times. And listeners didn't like this. They didn't like the fact that they would listen to the same song twice. So they actually had to program into the iTunes random song generator logarithm thing the idea that you wouldn't repeat the same song twice in a row, which to the person that wrote this in said that made it slightly less random, you know, yeah. Which I thought was a really cool example of it. And I'm just wondering what you guys think, or is this just solely a language problem? That's something that is truly mathematically random. And it's sort of, when you start thinking about it too much, you kind of just have to go, you know, stand in a closet upside down for a little while until the blood gets back into your head.
Yeah. So I think that you can have something which it depends on if you're using the phrase to refer to, say, a sequence of numbers, then you could certainly stretches of that sequence could be random, while other stretches may not be. So you could say that there is a certain amount of randomness in the number sequence,
right.
And therefore that could vary. You know,
mm-hmm.
More or less of the sequence can be random.
Right.
So if you allow the phrase to refer to part of the whole, then yes, there could be
like a closed system. That was kind of the thing, that within a closed system, yeah. You can have varying degrees of randomness or percentage yeah. of randomness.
I would say linguistically, if you just use the word random without any modifier, it refers to complete 100% total randomness, mm-hmm. and you have to modify it down from there by saying that it's, you know, partially random or somewhat random. I don't know that very random makes any sense, because you can't go beyond complete randomness. So probably make most sense to modify it down. The pleonasm in that sense that we joke about on the show all the time
is very
unique, right?
Yeah.
Because unique is one of a kind. How could you be more?
Or super unique. Yeah, right.
How can you be more than one of a kind? You
know? It's cool because it also brought up, people write in about saying how difficult it actually is to generate randomness, to generate random numbers.
Yeah, we
can.
Yeah.
It's that you sort of can't, because you can always trace it back to some. Now with quantum, I guess there's some discussion of quantum computing being able to actually, for the first time, generate a legitimately random number.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but for like your home computer and stuff, most programs use the date and time, I think, to generate random.
Well, they use it as a seed.
Things. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Or like, there's like temperature. Then, the sunset. Which I wasn't even aware. I mean, to me, it's all bingo balls. You know, to me, the randomness in it. But it's really hard to do that mechanically, or to do it computationally. Yeah. Computationally.
Older computers just had a string of random numbers. And I learned that the hard way. I wrote a program once to do some simulation or whatever, just to run, to generate a series of output that would be fed with the random generator in the computer. And after letting it run for a certain amount of time, it got back to the beginning again and started repeating itself. I actually like ran all the way through the loop of random numbers that were stored in the computer. I go, holy crap, this isn't really random.
You can go on Amazon and buy a book
that's
a million random digits with 100,000 normal deviations.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Now, I was wondering if you could like somehow use pi, or is the problem with that that it's you can calculate it, so that's the problem, is that it does have a
– No, but
there's no pattern.
It is random, though. You can use pi as a random number, but of course it's one random number. But you know what I mean? So it's random but predictable because it's pi.
Right.
but if you look at the sequence of digits in pi, they are statistically random.
Yeah, there's no pattern. There's no repeating pattern. Yeah. There's no.
Let's talk about now, because we kind of covered the mathematical end of it, but let's talk about when we say that was a random statement, George. Like, you're good at these random statements, right? What does that mean, and where's that coming from, and how random is it? Like, that's a really hard thing to wrap your head around, because
It's like a non sequitur. It just came out of nowhere, unrelated to previous conversation.
Yeah. I like elephants.
Right.
Well, that's not as random as you think, Ev, because we talked about elephants in this episode.
Speaking of segues.
It's funny. My daughter, who's 12, and her friends at school play the random game, which is what they call it, where they just shout at each other the most quote-unquote random or completely unrelated things that they can think of.
It sounds like a fun game. I'd play that game.
It's probably harder to do than you would think. It's really hard.
And then so she started playing it with me. And of course, I criticize her on it, saying, "Well, that's
you're a terrible father."
Yeah,
she loves it. She loves it. No, I said, "Listen, that's not random because that refers to something we just said." And I'm just trying to teach her what it really
that
means.
Uses vowels.
It's how hard it is to
that's
not,
English
to not be derivative to say something that really isn't derivative of anything. It's really hard.
When I sit and do my stupid Twitter feed that is basically just a sort of a series of not silly non sequiturs. I have to have what I do is I usually sit with a Flickr. I open up Flickr on my browser, and they have interesting photos of the last 6 days, and they'll show you 12 pictures at once. And then you kind of click and you can open up a new page, and I just stare at that, and hopefully something that I see will trigger some random thought that is connected to it. It might not necessarily be directly connected. You know, if I see a starfish, I might think of the beach or swimming or water, and I'll think of some water pun or something stupid like that. But to just sit in a coffee shop, you know, and not have that initial sort of random generator thing, it's very difficult for me to just come up with silly stuff. It's difficult anyway. And the end result is usually not humorous stuff, but anyone who's read my Twitter feed knows how lame it is. But, it's just so cool that like you need that initial, like first domino push, you know, through some image. So yeah, so the randomness is not quite as random as it would sort of randomly
seem.
You
need the seed.
The seed, yeah. And then it's really hard to be random.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Before we get started this week, George, I wanted you to tell our audience about your upcoming show.
Sure. We're doing a big concert in February. It's called 21812. That happens to be the date, which also happens to be a palindrome, which is kind of cool. February 18th, 2012, 21812. If you go to geologicconcert.com, there's all kinds of information. We have ticket packages available. It's going to be a full Geologic Orchestra concert show,
which is
a 10-piece band. It's me out front. It's five horns, drums, percussion, guitar, bass. Special guest flying in all the way from Boulder, Colorado. Yes, the one and only Dr. Phil Plait is going to come. He's going to do his version or our version of Death from the Skies with the full band, which has never been done before. He's performed with the trio, but he's never performed with the full band. There's going to be a bunch of special guests, possibly like that are related to me that like Jay-Z. I don't want to give away too much, but, oh, what the hell. Yeah, Mom will be there. She'll be doing a special bit. This is taking place right here in my hometown, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. It's a great venue called the Ice House. Tickets are available, and you can spend anywhere from $15 up to $1,000. Mm-hmm. Literally, you can whatever package you want. We are filming this. It's going to be a live album, and it's going to be a live DVD. So you get to have the back of your head be on the DVD if you want to come be part of the show. I know a bunch of the rogues will be there. We will involve them in the show somehow. I'm not quite sure how, but they will be involved. So come see them, come see me, come see Phil most of all. And it's going to be a really wonderful time. So again, it's geologicconcert.com. You can also go to 21812.eventbrite.com and you can get your tickets online, which I highly recommend doing because they're going pretty quick. Cannot wait. Very excited.
All right. Well, let's go on to science or fiction. Are you guys ready?
I'll go.
Okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
This is my holiday present to you because this week is very easy. Here we go. Item number one. Scientists have discovered bacteria capable of living in the subsurface of Mars. Item number two. Research finds that thick hair protects against bed bug bites, but despite this, hairy individuals are bitten as often as less hairy individuals. And item number three, a new study finds that UV light is 95% effective in reducing chickenpox severity and preventing its spread. George, as our guest, you may go first.
All right. Mars, I will say, is true. Because I'll say that life will find a way. I would say UV light is also true, and I will go just because of my my pate. I'm going to say that the thick hair is the fiction.
Okay.
The bed bug thick hair thing is the fiction.
Okay. Rebecca?
That's the only one that I thought was science. I was thinking that it makes sense that thick hair would prevent someone from feeling the bite, you know, the bug bite down, but it wouldn't make it past the hair. So that would explain people being bitten as often, but being protected by thick hair. So bacteria capable of living on Mars. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, we find crazy things like that all the time. So why not? UV light for reducing chicken pox, that seems weird. Although I can see how it might not have been well tested before, because when I had the chicken pox, I had to stay inside. So I'm going to say that one's the fiction, though, the UV light one. And I did not find this easy, Steve, because I really it's a coin flip for me between Mars and chicken pox. I'm going to go with the chicken pox.
Yeah. I just said that to make you feel bad if you get it wrong.
Yeah, thanks, jerk.
All right, Jay?
Yeah, so the first one about the bacteria living on the subsurface of Mars, I would imagine that if they found bacteria living on the actual subsurface of Mars, we would be talking about that and not having it be like a random thing. So that makes me think that they may have discovered that there are bacteria that can live in conditions like the subsurface of Mars. Research about the hair protecting people against bed bugs. So that now, what are we talking about here? Like, we're talking about like someone that's crazy hairy all over their body, and then like bed bugs try to get at them, and there's a problem with that. I guess the next question is like, how hairy can somebody get? Because sure, like if it's like, you know, if it's like a Sasquatch. You bet your ass that bed bugs would have a hard time getting in there. The study finds that UV light is 95% effective in reducing chicken pox severity and preventing. Now, I don't like that one because I think they would have figured that out a long time ago, because people are in UV light all the time, and then they would have said things like, you know, it would have been like an old wives' tale, go outside and the sun will help your chicken pox. I think people would have figured that
you're,
out.
You're sick. You stay inside. You're sick. Stay inside. Like Rebecca said, you're ill. Stay inside.
See, George,
they would never know.
Technically, that's kibitzing. But
I'm sorry.
Okay. I know you're.
Wait, table Rebecca, talk. I'm going to take that one as the fake. Dude, I think Rebecca picked that one.
Okay. All right,
but
Bob?
I did say it was a coin flip.
It's funny. I thought all three seemed somewhat reasonable. Now I think two are not. I'm all over the place. The bacteria living in the subsurface of Mars. Well, yeah, I mean, this is just, I mean, so frustrated because Steve knows that we will agree with anything that, any extraordinary thing that bacteria are claimed to do. I mean, there are, especially extremophiles, they could just survive so many different environments. So, very low air pressure. I'm sure they could survive, and I mean, there are bacteria that live off of minerals, and so yeah, I got to go with that, and I'm probably going to get nailed on it. The bed bug one, man, I've gone back and forth on this. I mean, I could see very thick hair protecting you, but still, there's so much other skin that's not going to be as thick elsewhere in your body that you could still be bitten a lot. But then again, if you've got lots of hair, there's lots of you, there's more of you spread out on the bed that bed bugs could latch onto and kind of climb their way up and bite you. So I could see how thick hair would actually help them. But the UV light, I mean, 95%, that's too big. That's too big of an effect. Yeah, the 95% just seems way too high. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay. And Evan.
Yeah, Jay, you said it, and that's what I was thinking. UV light, 95% effective. So, I think we would have found out a long time ago that UV light was that effective in reducing chicken pox. I don't think it would have taken this long. That's it. Yeah, that's fiction.
Okay. So you all agree that scientists have discovered bacteria capable of living in the subsurface of Mars.
Capable being the operative word.
Well, yeah. I mean, Jay's right. If they actually discovered bacteria living in the subsurface of Mars, it wouldn't be a science or fiction. It'd be all over the place. all over the place. And this one is science. Yes, this is what I meant by the easy one. This is easy. They found microbes living in a lava tube.
Microbes.
Living in conditions
cube.
Like those
cube.
On Mars.
Cube.
Yeah.
Lava tube. Lava tube.
Oh, they didn't actually recreate the conditions on Mars. They found conditions like Mars and found bacteria there. Cool.
Yeah.
Lava lamp.
They're able to tolerate temperatures near freezing and low levels of oxygen. And here's the key, and here's really the new bit, that they can grow in the absence of organic food. Under these conditions, their metabolism is driven by the oxidation of iron from olivine. O-L-I-V-I-N-E, a common volcanic mineral found in the rocks of the lava tube. So you're right, Bob. They're living on minerals, not on organic matter.
Organic.
Yeah, these conditions are pretty much the same as the subsurface of Mars, including the presence of olivine. No reason why these bacteria would not thrive in that condition.
Yay.
Good so far. So, all right, let's go to number three. A new study finds that UV light is 95% effective in reducing chickenpox severity and preventing its spread. George, you think this one is science. Everyone else thinks this one is fiction. Before I do the reveal, I want to ask you guys a question. What about when Dr. McCoy discovered that UV light would kill those cellular creatures that were parasites infiltrating Spock's body or other crew members?
Did you seriously make up a fiction based on Star Trek?
Podcasters, not Star Trek fans.
I'm shocked I didn't think of that.
Did you not think of that? Okay, let me read you the headline. This is from the BBC News. Sun stops chickenpox spreading. That's the headline of the article. But this one is a fiction.
Ta!
I knew it.
Because that's a very misleading headline.
It's just 94% of us.
It's not even clear that UV light is what's the critical element here. So this is what is known, that chickenpox spreads much more easily in temperate zones than in tropical zones, and it spreads more during the winter months than during the summer months.
What are the tropical zones on my body?
We can find out tonight if you want.
So a Dr. Phil Rice, reviewed this epidemiological evidence and tried to correlate the spread of chickenpox to the exposure to ultraviolet light. His hypothesis being that that's the key. That's why, in the tropical zone or during the summer, there's more UV exposure, and that is inhibiting the spread of chickenpox. And he wrote a paper making that argument. Even if you take his paper at face value, it's still nothing like 95%. So that figure is totally exaggerated. But this is not in any way an experimental study. It's purely observational. It's very speculative. And it's also been refuted by another publication showing that he failed to take into consideration the different temperate zone genotypes of the VZV, the varicella zoster virus, which is the chickenpox virus, and that they conclude UV radiation does not satisfactorily explain the distribution of VZV genotypes in different tropical and temperate regions of Mexico in the specific data sets they were looking at. So this is controversial, speculative, and not anywhere near the effect size that I implied. And I found the BBC headline to be just ridiculously misleading. which means that research finds that thick hair protects against bed bug bites, but despite this, hairy individuals are bitten as often as less hairy individuals, is science. What the researchers showed is that they essentially, you know, had volunteers with varying degree of hair on their arms expose them to bed bugs, and those with the hairier arms indeed had fewer bites, that the hair was protective. And there's two types of hair. You know, there's the thick.
Would you like to make $20?
Yeah. The guy walks out. I can only imagine that this was done on prisoners like prisoners of war as a human rights violation. That's the only way I can see this study actually being carried out. Who would agree to that?
Free short sleeve shirt.
So both the greater amounts of the longer, thicker hair and also the finer vellus hair, V-E-L-L-U-S, were protective. The fine hairs were useful because they enabled individuals to detect the presence of the bed bug on their arm more easily, that when the hairs are displaced, it gives you a sensation. You can feel the bug on you. But the thicker hair, it made it more difficult for the bed bugs to get access to the skin. Now, the reason this doesn't decrease the amount of bites is because when you're not in the lab with your arm, you know, being exposed, when you're in your bed or whatever, the bed bugs will find a place to bite you. So that unless you were completely covered head to toe, it wouldn't provide enough protection to reduce the amount of bites. It would affect where on your body they bite you, not if they bite you. So that one is science.
And there you have it.
And there you have it.
Sorry.
It's okay, George. You don't have as much practice as the other guys. Your reasoning was sound.
Trying to be quick.
It was a little tricky.
Yeah, I thought you were doing the Star Trek
yeah.
Fool.
That's probably what that's through you. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, George, you sounded cool when you were talking.
Well, that's 90% of it.
Right.
It's on the delivery. Crap, 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 nonsense, garbage, crap.
Ooh, George.
Where can I get some crap?
So what do you say, Steve?
I say, Jay, you have a quote for us?
I do. I love this quote. This is Christopher Hitchens being amazingly Christopher Hitchens. The only position that leaves me with no cognitive dissonance is atheism. It is not a creed. Death is certain, replacing both the siren song of paradise and the dread of hell. Life on this earth, with all its mystery and beauty and pain, is then to be lived far more intensely. We stumble and get up. We are sad, confident, insecure, feel loneliness and joy and love. There is nothing more, but I want nothing more. Mr. Christopher Hitchens!
It's like you're announcing him for a fight. It's awesome.
Hear, hear.
George, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you, guys. It's a lovely Christmas gift. Thank you.
We love having you.
What's that website
on
again, Geo?
GeologicConcert.com or just Google George Robb.
George Robb.
I'll be there.
Yeah, I hope you guys can all make it. It's going to be fun. Yeah. It's going to be fun, 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 fun.
Weather permitting, I will be there.
Yay.
It is inside, FYI.
Yes.
Indoors.
That's good.
Oh, I thought it was a real ice house.
False. It is a 19th century ice house, which is converted into a performance space. It's a really cool space.
That's awesome.
Thanks for joining me, everyone, this week.
Thank you, Steve.
You're good,
thank you, Steve.
It's our last regular show of 2011. Next week, we have the wrap-up show, which actually will air on December 31st. It'll be the last day of the year. It'll be our reminiscence of 2011. And until then, until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. You can also check out our other podcast, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website. or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.